The Arthropod. The Arthropod is the home for the wonderful, weird, wacky world of insects. Hosted by Jonathan Larson, Jody Green, and Michael Scavarla.
Welcome back, everybody, to Arthropod, your entomology podcast. I am one of your hosts for the day, Jonathan Larson of the University of Kentucky.
I'm another one of your hosts, Jody Green from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln.
And I'm the last host today. I'm Michael Scavarla of Penn State University.
And we are joined by a very special guest. I am going to let our very special guest introduce himself to the world today.
Hi, thanks. My name is Frank Meek, and I am the technical manager at Rollins, Inc., which is the parent company of Orkin Pest Control here in the U.S., and about, maybe 15 or 18 other pest control companies in the U.S. and around the world.
That sounds like a big role there. I know about Rollins as an entomologist. I've heard of Rollins and everything, but I know some people hire Orkin. They hire maybe one of your competitors, Terminex, and things like that out there. How is Rollins this juggernaut? Like, can you explain some of that to our listeners of just how Rollins got to be the pest management behemoth that it is?
So, you know, the story goes that I think it was like 1964, Rollins Inc. was this kind of medium-sized public broadcasting television company. And they provided or performed, I guess, what's now known as the first leveraged buyout in American business history, where this little small company found out about this large pest control company called Orkin that moved into Atlanta and bought it out. So it was a leveraged buyout that's still business case study at Harvard Business School. And so he bought Orkin and then started buying ancillary services to go with pest management, like security, maid service, and all these other things to take care of homes. And then over the years, kind of divested off of that to focus on the core competence of killing bugs and termites and all those other fun things. And then, you know, being the largest guy out there, they started buying up other companies. And we used to take those companies and roll them into Orkin. But then a number of years ago, maybe 24 years ago, we started buying them, these larger companies, and then just having them run as their own brand because they had great brand recognition in their individual markets. So why kill that marketing effort? So they report to the Rollins organization, but they're a standalone business within there. And Orkin is still the biggest of the batch out there. So put it in perspective, last year Rollins did about $2.4 billion in revenue. And Orkin by itself was about $1.4 billion of that. So it's still the big guy.
That's awesome. So it started as a public, as a broadcasting company and then switched to killing bugs. what was the impetus there? I mean, how did that switch over happen?
You know, and it really didn't switch because Rollins still has another side that's a lot of other companies out there. But I think it was just a great business opportunity.
Wow.
That they saw the opportunity to invest a little and make a lot, which is, you know, the mark of a good business person, I guess.
Yeah, for sure. That's awesome. I appreciate that history.
So it's worldwide.
Yeah. So we have four brands outside the United States that are corporate owned: Orkin Canada, Orkin Australia, a company in the UK, and then a company in Singapore. So those are all company-owned operations. There's another 70-plus operations now outside the U.S., 70 countries that have franchise of Orkin set up in them that we put in place starting about 2004, 2005, and then that's still going on today. So part of my career, and I joined Orkin in 1986, so 35 plus years ago. But the last, long time, from 2006 up till 2019, I was the director of international operations. And so I was involved in setting up a lot of those operations around the world and working in them, teaching them pest management and all those fun things. So yeah, it's been an interesting and diverse time period. A lot of changes in the business.
When most people think of pest control, what do you think they think?
I think the homeowners think about pest control. If you're in the South, you think about protecting for termites. If you're in the North, I need somebody to come in and spray for carpenter ants or kill the rats and mice and things like that. So people really think that the pest controller they still use the word exterminator, the pest mm-hmm. controller, the spray guy. In the commercial clients, quite often you'll hear them say, well, just fog. That's what you guys do. Just fog, just spray it. And they don't really understand the whole approach into pest management, which is understanding the biology, the habits, the desires of the creatures, knowing exactly when that cockroach comes in inside a box, where is it going to go? What's it going to do? What does it want? Where does it need? And where to find it? They don't really understand that there's a lot of science and thought put into the way that pests are managed. It's not just spray and pray as it used to be. I know when I started in the pest control business, it was a lot of that. You pumped up that B&G sprayer until, the seams started shaking and there was, a couple hundred pounds of pressure maybe in there. And you pulled the trigger and you let go and you got back to the door. That was pest control. It's a lot different now. So people don't really understand the science that's gone into that change and that growth and how much better it is today. What I really want people to think about pest controllers is to say that we are focused in four key parts of life. We protect property. The most expensive investment most people make, we protect the property. We're part of the public health. We protect people from diseases spread by pest. We control those animals. We don't kill them. We control them. We maintain the population where it's supposed to be, not eliminate it completely. We're part of the food protection scheme of the world. 48% of our grain is destroyed by pests before humans ever have a shot at it. And that's with everything we know how to do. So we also protect animals, people's, pets, they're family members. If you're my dog, you're a family member. You're not a pet. But the animals for profit are also a big part of our protection scheme. So that's what we do, is we provide public health, food safety, property safety, and animal safety. It's not just the exterminator.
Did you find during your international training that some places and cultures are more apt to engage in those kind of practices and promote it and be more into education?
Jody, there's both sides of the scale there. You've got places that just like, we've lived with them for thousands of years. Who cares? Hey, there's a cockroach in here. Who cares? As long as it's, not overeating my food, I just brush it to the side. But then you've got the other side of the scale where there's areas that just do not tolerate any type of pest. And we'll listen and work really hard with a pest management professional to do the things that are necessary to keep them out. And they'll go through and make the effort to provide exclusion, to provide sanitation, and all these necessities into the world of pest control. Regulations around the world have gotten tighter. So with things like, SQF, coming into play over the last few years, that's forced the food processing and the food industry to tighten up and to pay more attention to people like us. So it's on both sides. And today you still have people out there around the world that just say, hey, just spray it. Do it my way. Spray it down. Hose it down. By God, something will walk on it and die. And that's all I want. That's all I'm going to pay for. And we just walk away from those because that's not proper.
Why do you think the Orkin man is such a what am I trying to say, Jonathan?
Like an enduring symbol, right? He's an archetype almost.
Yeah, it's you know, that's the image that the company put together back in the 60s, and you know, we still wear ties into the office. We're not a casual company, even inside corporate. Our technicians wear uniforms, which was not always the case in the pest control business. There was actually, I think Orkin is credited with being one of the first or the first that has an actual uniform for a service technician. And that was introduced in World War II, I believe it was, to say, look, you trust the man in uniform, here he is. And that's just the image that it has. We're very much on that image and protecting it. You want that trust from the Orkin person. We're going into people's homes. Mm-hmm. We're going into their businesses. I know I've been inside places like the Metropolitan Museum of Art. I've been inside there, with guns pointed at all around in a room where they're refinishing priceless works of art. And it's like, oh, you're the Orkin guy. Go ahead, take care of it. Do what you need to do. And it's just that trust level that's built up over the years. And we're very proud of that and very focused on maintaining that.
Frank, did you know I was the Orkin man once?
I've heard that.
Yeah, I worked
the Orkin person.
Yes. And it was in Canada and I wore the uniform and it had the little... Some people thought I was like the meter person and they would come out and they would be like, don't give me a ticket. Don't give me a ticket. And I'm like, I couldn't give you a ticket if I wanted to. I'm just here to inspect this building. But it was very interesting. People were very curious at the time because it was over 20 years ago when I would show up at their house. Like, who are you? What are you doing? You're so little. You're a girl. And I was like, I'm the Orkin man. Don't I look like John Goodman?
You know, and the epaulets are on the shoulders. That's one of those identifiers that are out there. And that's still the residential uniform today, is the red epaulets on the white shirt. Yeah, that's an identifier. You know, it's funny you say that about the meter. So in Dubai, over in the Emirates, all the taxi drivers wear white shirts with red epaulets. So when we opened up in the Emirates, we had to kind of step back and say, all right, that's not going to be a great uniform look for us here. So we're going to go with, you know, khaki shirts and red diamond and such because that is a look that's used in a lot of other industries. So you have to separate it out sometimes.
It sounds like you guys have this sort of shared experience of wearing the epaulettes and being out in the field. You're the technical
manager.
Technical manager. Thank you. What's that career path like? Like getting from going out into people's homes, wearing a cool uniform. I kind of wish now that I had an entomology uniform. I think that would be dope. But what's the career path to go from that to where you're at now, which it sounds like has much broader responsibilities? I don't know. Do you get more of like a tassel situation on the shoulders the further up in the company you go? Or it's just like, what's the career path there, I guess?
Historically, people have come in at the bottom level, the lowest level there is in the company, as a service technician. My first job in the company was as a termite guy. So I was out selling termite services to customers and then going back the next day and actually doing the work, drilling the holes, digging the trenches underneath houses and applying the good old chlordane and heptachlor back in the day. And then you move into sales. And then if a person wants to, they make it known that, hey, I'd really like to kind of move up into management. So I did that and I took a really good pay cut and moved up into management out of commission sales and such. So it was the goal that I had was to move up as much as I could. So the step goes typically from service or sales or service and sales into local management. And then if you desire, you make it known and you can then elevate into region or division management or even into home office corporate. Technical, we really try to look at people that have that strong science mind, you know, to be able to step back and look at the situation and say, okay, here's what I see, here's what is happening, and here's the things we can do A to Z. we want people to have some background in entomology. A BCE, even an ACE would maybe come up into some of the technical stuff locally out and about in the regions. But from the corporate level, that's someone that has field experience and a science background that can mesh, because you've got to have that at that higher corporate level. Everything that we do, we have to be able to defend in court, unfortunately, sometimes. We have to be able to make it so that that technician that's never had a biology class or an entomology class or anything like that can understand it and then perform the service easily in a safe and environmentally, comfortable fashion. So it's a desire to move up, and there's a pathway there. Now, moving into a technical place is probably one of the hardest areas to go, because there's not a lot of us. You've got maybe 20 for the entire Rollins companies out there. Most pest control companies have one, maybe. Two would be a luxury. We, at corporate level, we have five, and then we've got all the brands have some technical people as well. So it's a select group to get into, and not the easiest. So having a background in business, having the science side, entomology, biology, all of those things is certainly, what you have to do to get into that area. But if you don't know the business, it doesn't matter how much science you know.
Where did you learn your entomology background?
Yeah, so, that's a really bizarre thing based on what I just said. So my education was not in entomology. I actually left college after 2 years and just took the two-year degree thingy in physical sciences and went to work where I was working at an electronics company. And it was just boring. I hated it. So I went back to where I had worked to pay my way through college, which was construction work, working in the lumber industry, building houses and things like that. And it's a bizarre story, Jody. So I was about, I guess it was 1984. My wife and I got married and moved to Atlanta. And I was working in the construction business, and I got hurt and couldn't continue that type of work. And the Orkin office was up the street from the little apartment we had. They had a sign out front that was hiring. Now, at the time in 86, it was my wife was pregnant with our first child. So I needed two eyes, income and insurance. So the Orkin office had a sign, like I said, and I said, I don't really know what they do, but I understand it's a good company. I'm going to go apply for a job and see what it is. And so I went up there and applied for the job. I had a ponytail, I had a beard, and it was just not the corporate image that they like us to have. So they told me, get your hair cut and shave, come back tomorrow, we'll put you to work. So I did that and thought, I'll do this until I can find a real job. So 35 years later, I'm still looking for a real job, I guess. But I just fell in love with what it was. I was excited at what I was doing for people and learning everything that I could. The technical people at the time, they did a lot of work inside the branch I was in field studies and field research, and I got involved in that. They started, it was Paul Hardy. Jody, if you remember Paul Hardy was a legend, or is a legend in the industry. He's invented a lot of the things that we do today. But Paul was the technical guy, and he kind of took me under his wing and brought me along. So then I decided to go back and start studying entomology and see what I could learn. So I just did classwork, distance classwork at Purdue, at University of Florida, Oklahoma State, Kentucky, every class I could find any place I took it. And then got my BCE.
Can you explain to the listeners what the BCE is?
Yeah. So that's BCE, as one customer told me one time, does that mean bug control expert? I said, well, if it makes you happy, yes. But BCE is a board certified entomologist. So that's a certification run by the Entomological Society of America. It's a testing of knowledge and oh, what's the right word? You go through a lot of study, a lot of testing on the knowledge of entomology, and it's not an easy test. It was probably one of the hardest things I've done in my
career. It was very hard. I still don't know the answers to the ones I got wrong.
I still don't know which ones I got wrong. So, I studied my rear end off of that for a couple of years and read. I may be the only person outside of university that actually read snodgrass morphology word for word, cover to cover. I did that study and attended a lot of classes and took my BCE certification and passed that. And now I maintain it. BCE is maintained through continuing education, through publishing research, speaking at conferences and such. As a matter of fact, I'll probably try to get a credit for being on here today. So, but you have to have like 120 credits every 3 years or something like that to maintain your BCE. But it's also a strict code of ethics in the science and in the consumer side of the business, making sure that we are there to educate, to teach, and to help. And that's what a BCE is.
And you did mention the ACE, which is a little different because you don't have formal background in entomology, and any of the technicians who get that or who are studying. I know I've proctored a couple tests here in Nebraska, but it's kind of like above and beyond some technicians that want to know more. So like those credentials are pretty significant in the industry, I think.
They are. You know, the ACE stands for Associate Certified Entomologist, and that's geared at that technician level. I think the only requirements of it is you have to have time in the industry. You have to be there. I think it's 2 years is the minimum, or maybe five. I have to go back and look. But once you've met that time, then it's just passing a certified test to get that designation. And it is something that we look at. Yeah, that tells us that a person wants to improve themselves, wants to keep learning. You know, if we ever stop learning, it doesn't matter how long we've been in the business someplace. If we stop learning and stop trying to learn, then we need to leave. We need to get out. That's just not right. You have to keep learning because, you know, these creatures keep learning. As you guys know, they change, they morph, they, I hate to think they think and learn, but it almost seems that way sometimes, the amount of change that goes on with them.
Yeah, they adapt and evolve. You mentioned about how you were just so excited about your job. What are the best and most exciting parts? Because I know, I know you've got some good stories.
I love a challenge. And to me, that's the great thing is the challenge of taking something that 2, 3, 4 other people have tried and failed at, and then stepping in to say, okay, let's step back and analyze and see what's happening. So it's the challenge that gets my blood pumping and keeps me showing up every day is that, you know, it's kind of strange. No one ever calls us up to check on our families. They only call us when they got a problem. So it's that problem solving opportunity that really is what it's about for us. You know, some of the problems are as simple as, I don't know what product to use. Or some of them are as massive as, I'll tell you one that happened to me in Lebanon years ago. We were protecting a beverage plant that was our customer, and they were very much concerned about flies, house flies, getting into their delivery trucks parked in the lot, not into the processing area, but into their delivery trucks, because they didn't want to open the truck in front of the customer and flies come out of it. So when we got out to look at the situation, they had tried treating the outside. They had tried a lot of things that just wasn't working. So I went over there and was helping them with it. But you look at it and there's a farm on one side of this building that raises sheep, goats, all this fun stuff, shares a property line. On the other side of the building, sharing the opposite property line, is the abattoir, where they go and kill and slaughter all these animals. And then you've got this beverage plant in the middle. So you've got, you know, this cross fly population all the time. So, you know, how do you solve that? Those types of problems are, you know, where I get involved and get in and just dig into what are the unique and crazy solutions. And sometimes the solutions aren't spraying pesticides. Actually, most of the time, there's not spraying pesticides. In that particular case, we started analyzing wind currents, wind speeds, wind directions, at what time of day. And then we started setting up interception points around the outside of the building to catch the flies at the fence and prevent them from ever getting up towards the building or towards the trucks. But to do that, you had to study and analyze all the conditions that were making them move around. Where were they coming from? Which directions were the flies flying? Where was the odors coming from to attract the flies in? So it's that thinking through those problems that, you know, that makes it exciting sometimes.
And intercept them.
You intercept them. Yeah. Keep them from ever showing up.
like traps.
Judiciously placed traps, baits. So there are some really good fly baits that we can use. When we were researching the fly baits, when they first came out, I'll have to go to a sidebar really fast. I wanted to test it out and see it for myself. So I went to the market and I bought a salmon and let it sit out in the Georgia sunshine for about 3 days till it was just good and ripe. And you can imagine the flies coming to it then. And then we put bait stations with the new fly baits out around it. This was back in, I guess, 2000, 2001. Put fly bait out around this salmon and then physically watch the flies move from this rotted, putrid fish over to the fly baits to eat it and then just drop dead. So, you know, developing those sort of things lets us get back to my place in Lebanon. We can put those fly baits that are so attractive around the perimeter away from the building and just stop them. So again, it's an IPM solution. Integrated pest management still works as long as you think it through. And, you know, those are situations I like. I've got, you know, stories like that from all over. We had a huge fly problem in Dominican Republic and appeared in a kitchen inside one of the resorts. And you track it back down, it's because there was a whale washed up on the beach about a half a kilometer down. And the flies were coming up from this, you know, rotting whale carcass. You know, so what do? You call the Navy, their boat comes and tows it out and blows it up in the ocean, and fly problem gone.
I can't say that I've ever had to call the Navy in for one of my customers or anything. Maybe someday. I appreciate hearing you talk about IPM just because I know about a year ago you won an award for IPM, which is obviously very impressive. And it gives me hope for the future to hear people talk about IPM. And, you know, in the past, I've had conversations with folks, some from the pest control industry, some from just agriculture and things like that. Oh, IPM is dead. And so to have somebody that works for Rollins in particular just sort of champion that, I think is very heartwarming and affirming for the future, I guess. Because you're right, there are so many other pest control opportunities. There's so many ways that we can try to get at these problems. So I just wanted to say that it makes me happy to hear that. And if you got to get the Navy involved, I guess you got to get the Navy involved.
But thank you. It's IPM is such a bizarre thing. If we can chat about that for half a second, you know, I've said if I put 100 pest controllers in a room and say, what is IPM? I'll probably get 95 different answers because it means something different to everybody. You get everything from, you know, Jonathan, as you were saying, you'll get everything from, it doesn't work. So it's just a marketing thing. It's something you say to make people feel good. No, it's not. You'll get people that says, well, it's pest control without chemicals. No, it's not. Well, it's pest control, but you only use that green organic stuff that doesn't really work. No, it's not. So, you know, that's the challenge internally, but the real challenge out there is the customers getting there to understand, look, I'm putting this mouse trap here for this reason. Well, yeah, but that's not where I see the mouse. True. But I'm putting it here for a reason. Leave it alone. Overseas, it's still very much a spray and fog. And I've run into countries that have no rules or regulations about that, where it's perfectly legal to walk into a working commercial kitchen and spray liquid pesticides. And, you know, that's a mentality that I've worked really hard to change around the world. And We've been instrumental in getting regulations put in place in these areas. We've been very focused on getting the management practices to change. And as these big companies move in, that slowly is changing the culture in these places to the better, to make it where integrated pest management does work. And it does include the use of chemicals when it's necessary, but there's so many other things that you can do first that solve problems. So it's that's probably one of the biggest challenges that I ran into overseas was getting that understanding and getting people to trust us. You know, I've gone into people and said, look, if it doesn't work, I'll give you your money back and leave and you go find someone else to do it. But I'm telling you, if you'll give me 60 days, we can prove it.
I appreciate you using that word trust. I was actually trying to formulate a question kind of built around that with an international experience with a career that spans, that sounds like a couple of decades. I mean, with talking about IPM and just pest control in general, do you find that people's trust in the industry has changed over time? And does it change as you jump nation to nation? And in particular, when you're talking about IPM strategies, because I know from my experience, I tell somebody, oh, what you need is a pantry moth trap, or you need to sanitize this thing, and then you won't deal with this bug anymore. Mm-hmm. But they don't trust that as much. They don't trust that idea as much. So do you find that that trust has gone up or down? And then like trust in pest control in general, do you think that the industry has been better received as time has gone on, or has the advent of Facebook and like home remedies and stuff that propagates on there changed what they believe you say as well? That's a lot of cans of worms that I just tried to open all at once.
You know, I'm thinking back to a number of years ago when I was a technical person for the U.S. before international, and I got a call one night. It was a Friday evening, actually, from the vice president of operations of the company. And he says, what are your plans this weekend? And my first answer was, well, I guess it depends on what your next sentence is. So he says, we've got a situation. I need you to go to the airport, grab your gear bag, go to the airport, buy a ticket at the counter. I need you on a plane. I need you in Oklahoma City tonight. And it's like, okay, well, give me some background here. He said, well, every major news media outlet's going to be there. We already know that CNN has a correspondent standing at this house. The local ABC, NBC, CBS affiliates are all there. And we think they've even set up hidden cameras. So you're on. Like, oh boy, okay. And it was a bed bug problem. So I go to the airport, jump in the plane and get out to OK and get out to this person's house. And they meet me at the door with a stack of papers. And I said, what's this? And she says, this is everything you have ever written, published, or said about bed bugs. I've looked you up. I know every word that you've ever said about this insect. So I don't know if you can fix this problem because I think you're full of, well, okay. So we went in and we got the problem. And, you know, long story short, 2 days later, she was out recommending us to her neighbors because we came in, we used all the right words and the right actions to get rid of the problem. But people look us up. People, there's a ton of, I call them Google entomologists in the world that will bring you four ideas of what will work if you'll just follow that. So I think the trust has built over, is improved. It's gotten a lot better because people see the results. And my approach going into another country or even into a city someplace is you don't have to teach everybody. You don't have to gain the trust of everybody. You have to gain the trust of one or two right people and the word will spread. And then that trust is built. So I think it's gotten a lot better just because of those sort of things. I try to explain IPM in a way that helps people understand it. So, and here's the analogy I use. If you're sick, you go to a doctor. And if you walk in and say, you know, doctor, I've been coughing. I know I've got bronchitis. I need an antibiotic and some steroids. I don't think any doctor's just going to pop it to you and send you out the door. They're going to examine you. They're going to listen to your chest. They're going to maybe take some x-rays, blood work or whatever. So they're going to do an evaluation, an inspection, as we call it in pest control. And then from that evaluation, they're going to design a treatment program to control your bronchitis, if that's what it was. They're going to maybe make a prescription of some medication. If it's something else, they may, you know, prescribe therapy or rest or whatever, but they're going to make a prescription action, a treatment, if you will, in pest control words, of their evaluation. And then every one of them is going to call you back in, or say, come back in 2 weeks, come back in 4 weeks, and let me monitor and see if it worked, and then see what we need to change. And that's the same as pest control is. Inspect, take x-rays, blood work. We design a treatment program and put it into place, prescription, exercise, whatever. Monitor, make sure it worked. Come back and see me in a week or a month. And that's the analogy I use to get people to understand the approach. And I've seen that work in a lot of ways and get people to understand and believe in what we're trying to talk about. It's just put it in words that they understand. Make it simple.
That's good. I taught about like the label the other day, and I pretty much just had like a pill container and was like, if I threw this at you without a label and was like, hey, take 5 of those. I'm like, should you really listen to Jody Green? Like, I'm not that kind of doctor. Don't ever do that. You need the label. You need to figure out what to take. You need to figure out what's going to happen, how to, you know, what it's for and how to use it properly, so nobody gets sick. And I was like, you can't, you're not going to take that. Like, I hope you don't.
Yeah. Or drink this glass, you know? Yeah. Yeah. I can probably throw out the Latin as good as you guys can and, you know, try to impress you with big words, but people don't understand that. So you talk to them at their level in a way that they understand, and they build up trust, especially when it works. If you can put out cockroach bait and say, okay, let me tell you exactly what's going to happen. In 3 days, you're just going to suddenly stop seeing cockroaches. In 5 to 7 days, you're going to start seeing a lot of little bitty cockroaches walking around. And that's great. That's the way it's supposed to work. And when people see that happen, now, all of a sudden, you're a pretty smart guy. You told him exactly what was going to happen and it worked. And that's what happened. And so that trust, you know, Jonathan, coming back to your point, your question there is that trust builds and has built by telling them what's going to happen, doing the work properly, and making it happen. Then they trust you.
From your experience, is there a certain type of insect or pest that is the biggest problem? I know you've talked about two different fly issues. And I know when I did that fly talk, there was that question about Ford flies in the mausoleum.
Yeah.
And that just seemed like a huge issue that nobody talks about, but very common to you. Are flies a huge problem everywhere?
Yeah, we probably flies around the world. Mosquitoes around the world, you know, your three basics, you know, the Anopheles, Culex, and the other one.
80s.
Thank you. Yeah. You know, I'm only on my second cup of coffee, so that's a problem. Those are everywhere. Rodents, big issue. I probably deal more with rodents and flies from a help standpoint, from helping people, you know, technicians out there figure out what to do. But those are probably the toughest ones. Cockroaches have become easy. With the advent of the bait materials and the IGRs, cockroaches really, if you know the insect, it's become pretty easy to keep them under control. Ants, depending on where you're at, can be a huge challenge. And then, but the rodents and the flies are probably what still give us the most headaches at times. I know I'm dealing with a couple of large warehouses now that we've been working in for months and months trying to crash rat populations that are internal. They're not coming in. We've fixed all that, but just the breeding cycle is moving faster than you can take them out. Rodents and flies, I guess, are probably the most difficult. Bed bugs, you know, bed bugs are there. I've been in so many places around the world where bed bugs are like, yeah, you know, we've dealt with them for 100 years, who cares? But here it's, you know, it's like, we don't want them. But it's not the same everywhere. Going back to something we said earlier, the tolerance level for insects and pests is much different in a lot of different places. And there's a lot of misconceptions about bugs out there. I worked at the big temples in Cambodia, where they were convinced that the termite colonies underground, that if they died, that these stone walls at Angkor Wat would just collapse because of the colony structure being gone in the soil. Well, you know, these colonies have died 100 times over in the last 1,000 years, and the walls are still up. So, yeah, there's a lot of misconceptions about them. But the fun thing is that a cockroach lives and dies the same way, regardless of its address. And if you know what it needs and what it's going to do, you can control it anywhere. Just getting that trust to let you do it.
I like that. I like that phrase. I'm going to maybe steal that in the future. I'll attribute it to you, of course.
But, you know, it's funny. Marketing came to us when we started International. They came and said, all right, you know, to make sure we've got the search engine optimizations all working and all that fun stuff, we got to have different verbiage about every insect. Well, but they're the same. What I'm going to say about a German roach is the same regardless of where we're at. Every country, it's the same bug. Maybe call it something different, you know, and it's not a German roach everywhere. There's a lot of places they call it something different, but, you know, it doesn't change. It's the same. You know, I guess to your question, Jody, that's the rats and the flies are probably what keep me up at night trying to solve and find solutions for. You know, the research that we did at Florida years ago, we found that the flies are, you know, just deadly insects. We discovered in our research there, we discovered 6 additional organisms that the fly was carrying that was not in the 66 green bird list. We found that they actually carry Acinetobacter, which is the spark plug for meningitis. So there's still a lot to learn about these guys out there. And so that's why I like working with them so much.
Are there any like super annoying random ones that were like really exceptional cases for you that you can think of?
Lessor earwigs. The lesser earwig, which is a very small, tiny earwig that lives underneath concrete slabs and can fly. I remember we had this situation in a cheese factory that where the earwigs, these lesser earwigs, were coming up through cracks in the slab, joints in the slab, and coming up into the production area. Well, you can't spray pesticide in a cheese production area. You can't do all the work that you really need to do from a chemical standpoint. Exclusion wouldn't work because of all the caustics that go into that environment. So again, get outside the box, brought in a chemical company, and we drilled the concrete slab like it was a termite job. And we injected an acid underneath the slab to physically destroy the organics that they were eating on and living on underneath the concrete slab to solve the problem. And then vulcanized rubber throughout the inside to seal it up so that nothing could come back through there. Every time we sealed it up before killing them, they just made their way back through. So yeah, those types of challenges that was a bizarre one. You mentioned the Ford flies. People always like to get grossed out at the Ford fly story. I told it to Faith Oy, and it's the first time I think I've ever seen Faith turn a little green. But we had a mausoleum that was just overrun with Ford flies. Found that in the mausoleum, if you've ever looked at how one is constructed, so the casket goes in, and it goes in at a slant angle down, so that as the body decomposes, all that slush runs out and goes into this drainage system and goes through and accumulates in a vat underneath the building. And then it off gasses through exhaust through the top. And if they don't unplug the drain before they put the body in, it'll build up inside that little area where the casket is, and the fly population just goes wild inside there. And if they do unplug the drain properly, then it starts in the drain lines and in the vat underneath, and it'll go all the way from the sub vat up through the exhaust in the top with just these Ford flies. And the only way I discovered that was we had a tomb opened, and I crawled down inside there, and crawling around inside this place, learning what what's going on back here where we can't see, and what can we do to fix that? We fixed it. We come up with a program to net the exhaust to keep the flies from moving in and out, put in biologicals because you can't spray pesticide on dear departed Uncle George, but you can put biologicals in the drains and in the system to help break everything down and dissolve it out faster so that the flies don't have a place to breed. That story gets a lot of people kind of like, but you know, that's what we do.
Yeah, that gave me the ookies a little bit. I was actually very intrigued. I Googled mausoleum drainage system, and there's some pretty fascinating photographs. So I had no clue that that was the way that that worked. I never even thought about it. I could see definitely where there's a lot of complications and that could go completely wrong. And then you got to come in.
And it's not that the flies are going to hurt anybody, but it's certainly something you don't want people standing there while they're, you know, mourning their loss of waving flies away from their face. It's just not right. I've run into those situations a lot where it's just something so bizarre and out of the way that regular approaches don't work. And that's where it's fun, is jumping in and analyzing these, breaking them down and coming up with unique solutions that do not depend on chemistry. Always. There's an aspect to it at times, but it doesn't always solve there. One other real kind of unique issue that I worked on that you might find interesting, oil well platforms out in the Gulf of Mexico. What do you think the big pest issue is on an oil platform? What do you think?
My heart wants to say seagulls.
Yeah.
Maybe, yeah.
Something that feeds on bird poop.
Would you believe ants?
I wouldn't have.
Pharaoh's ants. Huh. So Pharaoh's ants get transferred out with supply.
That makes sense.
Some cockroaches get transferred out with supply. We probably did more work for Pharaoh's ants on oil wells, on rig platforms in the Gulf than any other pest, because those are resupplied with people and product. And they got the perfect environment. They've got a captive audience of protein source that they can feed on. That was a fun, unique one. And sometimes it makes us get training and learning in areas that we would have never thought of. So if you go out to an oil well platform, you've got to be trained and certified in deep water survival, confined spaced entry, a whole bunch of other things. We learn a lot about other things in doing these weird little projects out there. Another one you might find interesting is Forbidden City in China. So years ago, the curators were moving into an area of Forbidden City that's not open to the public, called the Quinlong Gardens. And this is an area that no one's been in hundreds of years, except for curators. When they got in, they discovered that a lot of the old paper adornment, the tapestry adornments, were being eaten by stored product insects, paper insects. I was in China. We have a lot of operations in China. I was there working and flew up to the Forbidden City and got to crawl through these buildings and underneath them in places that no one's been in hundreds and hundreds of years, finding these unique little, you know, minute scavenger beetles, various species of socids that were getting in there and just chewing up on all the mold and the fungus and doing damage to all these antiquities, as well as the wood-boring beetles getting into some of these things that are, you know, just ancient, and seeing stuff that no one has seen in our lifetime to solve these issues. So it's been fun.
That does sound fun. That doesn't sound like something they would cover in Malice.
No, I probably should have put that in my chapter, but I didn't. Yeah, you know, the fun part of this is solving problems. The fun part of this is helping people and teaching people. That's what I look at every day, and that's what makes me keep going every day, is knowing that today I'm going to say something, show something, or do something to a young person in the field that's going to teach them something and help them feel better about themselves and what they did for the customer. And that's what I push for every day, is simply that.
With so many unique stories, and I mean, frankly, I'm learning a lot. The mausoleum one especially got me. Do you have, aside from like speaking to us now, like ways that you get that out? Is there a way in the company to
tell these stories to technicians, like, this is the problem we had, this is how you would approach it if you encounter something like that in the field? Do you, you know, is there trade publications that you put this kind of stuff in? I guess, how do you disseminate this knowledge that you're coming up with?
You know, that's a concern I have, is because, you know, the industry is getting older and the young guys coming up, you know, we're going to lose a lot of this if we don't keep it telling it and write it out. I thought about writing a book that says, this is everything I've forgotten, but, you know, maybe one day. But we do a lot internally for our company. We have a broadcast studio at Rollins that we broadcast out to thousands of employees every month. The technical people do a broadcast once a month on a particular subject, and we include a lot of this information in recorded video. So we're capturing a lot of that for posterity, if you will. All of us in the technical team, we do a lot of public speaking. Next week, I'm speaking at the International Food Distributors Association meeting virtually. I'm doing a one-hour seminar on supply chain tracing. If a pest ends up inside your factory, how do you go about determining where it came from and putting that stop in place? We'll be out at the IPM symposium in Denver in March. Got a session there that I'm going to be talking about and recording with these, you know, with some of these experiences in unique situations that involve taking an IPM approach outside of the box, like blowing up a whale or something. But we try to do that a lot just to get it out there. And I think it's part of our responsibility to the industry is to make sure that these things don't die, make sure that these novel ideas and approaches don't die and go away when we do. I've got a few more years, but not a lot. So, you know, somehow we have to make sure that that stays around and doesn't get lost. So maybe I should write that book one day. But for now, we do put a lot out in media, do a lot in the press. We also do a lot internally, recording a video and such like that.
Maybe instead of a book, you can do like one of those calendars. And so like every day you can have like a story and what you learned, and then every day you can flip that over. So then maybe that's not as daunting as writing a book, but I'd really like you to write that book. Okay. The one question I had written down, have you ever been scared? I feel like I've often crawled through these places. And when I say that, I know that I've been scared sometimes. Have you been scared crawling through some of the places you've crawled through?
I think the only thing that really ever frightens me is when I find like a baby snake or a snake skin. I don't mind finding an adult snake, but if I find the baby, I don't know where mama is, and she's probably ticked that I'm there. So, you know, I've been more afraid in some countries just for the general atmosphere towards Americans and such in some areas than I have been about the environment that I'm going into. Mm-hmm. As long as you're doing it safely, I've never really had that issue. Now, it helps that if you're not afraid of heights, that's a good thing. To Michael's point, you got those seagulls up there. Well, if you can't climb that 300-foot tower to get up to where that nest is to rattle the eggs, you know, probably don't need to be trying to do that. I'm not claustrophobic, so I've never had an issue crawling in to tight, confined places. In South Georgia, if you go underneath a crawl space, it may only be 18 inches off the ground. I know I've actually gone under some with a shovel and dug a path out in front of me so I could get through the underneath of a house. So I would say that I personally have never. I've trained people and run into those problems. Years ago, I was teaching a young man about termite inspections. So it was an old house that had been added onto. So it had a second crawl space. And I got half of my body through and a rattlesnake was in front of me underneath the crawl space. So I told the young man behind me, I said, hey, look, just don't move fast. Just very slowly back up. Don't even turn around. Just back up the exact same way you came in and I'll talk to you outside. And he was curious. What is it? What is it? And then he actually crawled up on top of my back to look through the hole that I was in. And he saw the snake. And all I heard was, oh, and then, ow, ow, ow. He hit his head on every floor joist running. He tried to stand up in a 12-inch crawl space. And just, I get outside and his head's, you know, busted open across his forehead where he hit things. And yeah, you run into people that get you into trouble sometimes like that.
So instead of a rattlesnake bite, he got a concussion. It sounds like.
Right, exactly.
All right.
I got in the truck and he said, take me to the office. I quit.
Wow.
And that's another quick thought is that people in this business, in the pest control business, no one grows up wanting to do this. You know, no little boy or girl ever grew up saying, I'm going to be a pest controller. You fall into it and you love it and you stick with it, or you hate it and we try to run you off as fast as possible. Because if you don't love it and don't enjoy the work, you're not going to be any good at it. My son's a technician with Orkin and he loves every bit of it. And I'll ask him, so what'd you do today? He said, I emptied my shop back 5 times in a warehouse. I'm like, great. What'd you spray? Nothing. That's my boy. So I've never been in that situation of being totally afraid, but I've been with people and had to talk them off the ledge, so to speak. There are places around the world that are not comfortable, but we do what we have to do for the job and for the good of people.
When you were in the international operations, where did you live?
Right here in Atlanta.
Or did you still live here? Okay.
Yeah, I still lived here. I lived in Nassau for 3 years. My first international gig was back in the mid-90s. We had an operation in the Bahamas, and they asked me to go over there to help them solve some rat problems. We got over there and found out that the branch had more problems than just rats. So they terminated the staff and said, Frank, can you, sit over here for a while and just manage this and get it back, turn it back around and such. And he said 6 weeks, and that turned into 3 years that I lived there without the family or the kids. And cause I have 2 kids and my wife and they stayed here and I lived over there, but all my other international stuff was based out of here. I was traveling at one point, probably 80% of the year. Shoot, I've logged well over 3 million airline miles on different airlines and probably got enough hotel points to never pay for a room again, but always here. And that's one great thing that the company's done is said, look, you've got a life, you've got a family. We're not going to uproot them and send them around everywhere with you. So you live by the biggest airport in the busiest airport in the world. Go for it.
If you had not gone into this industry, what do you think you would have done?
That's a tough thing. I probably would have still been in the carpentry wood building business or something along those lines. Maybe got my teaching degree because I love to teach people. So I may have gotten my teacher certificate and taught the shop class at the high school or something. But that's probably what I would have done. And probably wouldn't have had near as much fun.
Do you do that as a hobby?
Yeah, I've got a nice shop set up in the behind my house, and I still do some woodworking and crafting and such. And I enjoy that. I've gone on with my church group. I've gone on a lot of mission trips to third world countries and built buildings and schools and things like that. Just putting those old skills back to work at times. So I still enjoy it. And I'm big into music. I'm sitting here at my desk at my house and I have 3 guitars on the other side of the computer screen here. So I'll take a break in the day and, sit in my old fashioned wingback chair with my leather hat and put my guitar voice on and go for it.
That's awesome. I really like that hat, by the way. Our listeners couldn't see it, but it was pretty dope. That seems like a good spot to kind of wrap up. I just want to say I appreciate this conversation. This has been really enlightening, and I appreciate hearing kind of a perspective on the pest control industry from somebody who's been in it for a while and has been all over the place. So thanks for joining us here today on Arthropod, Frank.
Thanks so much. I certainly enjoyed talking with you guys.
Is there anything that you would like to promote that's online where people could connect with you or connect with Rollins?
Well, our websites, of course, Orkin.com, Rollins.com. I'm not personally on social media anywhere except on LinkedIn, so you can hook me there. But look for us at any of the major conferences. If you're in the pest control industry, look for Rollins and Orkin people at all the major conferences. Chances are we're speaking there about something. And then people can always reach out directly to me. I love talking to people and helping them. So you can always reach out directly to me at fmeek@rollins.com, and I'm happy to talk with folks.
Hopefully people can find you through that and maybe talk to you about a career in the industry. It sounded like a really interesting pathway that you've taken. And I think that this is a good exposure for folks who are maybe looking for alternative careers in entomology that don't involve having an email address that ends in edu. So thank you for sharing all that with us here today as well. You can find the show on the internet. We are on our blog at arthro-pod.blogspot.com. You can find the show on Twitter. We are arthro_podshow. I am also on Twitter at bugmanjohn.
I'm at Jody Bugsme, UNL.
And I'm at mscavarla36.
We are looking forward to releasing this episode and recording our next one. We'll catch you in a couple of weeks here, and we'll be talking to the Better Common Names folks from the Entomological Society of America. So look forward to that one, and we'll see you here soon.
It's time for our insect heroes to put away their nets and pheromone traps. Join us next time, same bug time, same bug channel, as the Arthropod Gang make the world safe from poor insect podcasts. Until then,
keep on bugging.
Hey, Frank, can I take a picture of you with your hat?
Sure.